did I already finish 11? I mean, is this where... Did I go on? I didn't get to 12 yet, is what I'm saying. Okay. So I did actually already talk about 11. What is 11? What is this whole complex called? It is protein kinase A. And what activates it? Cyclic AMP. And what actually creates cyclic AMP? What makes, what transforms AMP, I mean ATP into cyclic AMP? Adenylyl cyclase, which is an enzyme. What activates adenylyl cyclase? A G protein. What activates the G protein? Whatever the ligand is that binds to that G protein coupled receptor, right? Okay, that was just a quick review. Let's go on to 12 then and talk about still other kinds of second messengers. In 12, we're looking at a little piece of a membrane, plasma membrane. The left side of this is the membrane itself, as you see. The right side is the cytosol, so this is the interior of the cell. And the plasma membrane, as you know, is made up of a lot of phospholipids plus proteins and other things thrown in there in the mix. Well, not all phospholipids are the same. There are different kinds of phospholipids, right? But the majority of phospholipids in a typical cell will be phosphatidylcholine, just a type of phospholipid. One other type, there are several types, but one other type that's in there, not nearly as much as the as these phosphatidylcholine phospholipids, is a phospholipid that is called phosphatidyl inositol bisphosphate, or PIP2. And so instead of it being phosphatidylcholine, which has choline on the polar head, this thing has inositol bisphosphate on the head instead. Okay? So the phosphatidyl part refers to the two fatty acid tails that make it hydrophobic, and that's, you know, you have that basically in all phospholipids. Now notice that it's called PIP2, but there are three phosphates, because one phosphate is the phosphate that is associated with the glycerol to make up part of that polar head, like you see in all phospholipids. Okay? Connected to that, then, is the inositol bisphosphate. Inositol is the sugar here in the hexagon with two phosphates connected to it. So inositol bisphosphate stuck to something that already has a phosphate on it actually makes it have three phosphates, but it's called phosphatidyl inositol bisphosphate. Notice that phospha, the beginning of that, accounts for that third phosphate. Okay, so phosphatidyl inositol bisphosphate, or PIP2, is just a membrane component. It is a phospholipid in the membrane. And at the moment, it's not doing anything as far as signaling is concerned. It's just a phospholipid among many. But it can become two different signal molecules if it's given a signal to do so. All right, now that requires cleaving the phosphatidyl inositol molecule into two pieces, which not surprisingly is accomplished with the help of an enzyme. The enzyme's name, shown at the top there, is phospholipase C, named for the fact that it splits a phospholipid. Now, there are different kinds of phospholipases, which is why this one's called phospholipase C. In fact, there are different kinds of phospholipase C even. But a phospholipase is something that breaks apart a phospholipid. In the case that the phospholipid being broken by the phospholipase C is phosphatidyl inositol bisphosphate, then the two things that it gets broken into are diacylglycerol, DAG, and inositol trisphosphate, or IP3. Okay? So we're not adding a phosphate here because there were three already. But now we're going up to a three simply because of the way this thing is named. Okay? You're not gaining a phosphate here. So the inositol bisphosphate plus the phosphate that formed the bridge with the rest of the phospholipid originally, all of that gets taken off. And so what you have is an inositol with three phosphates on it. That's IP3, inositol trisphosphate. And that, notice, is freed into the cytosol. It is a hydrophilic compound. So it is just dissolved in the cytosol at this moment. The diacyl glycerol is left behind attached to the membrane. It is part of the membrane. And notice the name diacyl glycerol, very similar to triacyl glycerol, right? Which is, what is triacyl glycerol? It's what? Can't hear you. Well, that's, yes, it features three chains, but what is a triacyl glycerol? A fat. It's another name for a fat. Fat, triglyceride, triacyl glycerol all mean the same thing. A glycerol molecule with three fatty acids, right? Well, phospholipids have a glycerol as well, but they just have two fatty acids connected to them. And when you get rid of this polar head, and in that third position that normally would have a fatty acid attached to it to make a fat, you just have a hydroxyl, then what you have is a diacyl glycerol molecule. All right? Both diacyl glycerol and inositol trisphosphate are now activated signal molecules. And they can go on to cause other things to happen. Different things at the same time in response to the original signal that caused phospholipase C to be activated, which is what broke phosphatidylinositol bisphosphate into these two signal molecules, IP3 and DAG. Okay? And so this is another one of these versatile signal molecules, actually two of them, because it becomes two signal molecules that do various things in various tissues. In 13, we can see just a partial list of the various things that get triggered by the activation of IP3 and DAG. And it's not that I want you to memorize all these examples, because they're just examples, but you should see the trend here. That's what we've been talking about, is that signal molecules are versatile. They do different things in different cells because they're activated in different pathways. It all depends on what the entire chain of events that make up that signal transduction pathway are. And it can end up doing totally different things in different cells in response to the original signal. The first messenger is the ligand originally that binds to the receptor. These IP3 and DAG are just secondary messengers, right? Second messengers in the signal transduction cascade. Okay, well, let's see more about the action of this phosphatidylinositol bisphosphate. Slide 14. The phospholipase C that splits phosphatidylinositol bisphosphate into inositol trisphosphate and diacyl glycerol can actually exist in different forms. There are multiple different phospholipase Cs. And so in this example, the particular phospholipase C that does the splitting of PIP2 into DAG and IP3 is itself activated by a G protein, just like we've already studied. So the ligand molecule, that's the original signal, the first messenger, labeled L. And, you know, it could be any of several different things, depends on the cell. But the ligand binds to the G protein-coupled receptor, and everything we've already talked about happens, right? That causes dissociation of the alpha subunit from the beta and the gamma, and the displacement of the GDP on the alpha with GTP. That activates the G protein. In its active form, it then migrates along the interior surface of the plasma membrane, and in this case, the thing that it hooks up with is the version of phospholipase C that I was talking about. Phospholipase C is activated by the G protein, and now it is able to do its job as a phospholipase, which in this case is to cleave phosphatidylinositol bisphosphate into diacylglycerol, which sticks around as part of the membrane, and inositol trisphosphate, which is now in the cytosol. That's all happening right here. Now, the inositol trisphosphate part of PIP2 is exaggeratedly big in this picture. It's not really that huge compared to the diacylglycerol that stays behind. But anyway, that's what's happening here. Now we have IP3 on its own in the cytosol. It is a signal molecule. And diacylglycerol in the membrane, also a signal molecule. Okay, well, those signal molecules can do various things as an ultimate effect. But they both can operate, well, the typical thing that diacylglycerol does is to activate still another protein kinase, protein kinase C, is activated by diacylglycerol. Okay, so protein kinase C is already there, but it's not activated until diacylglycerol comes along. Well, that's not the ultimate effect either, right? Phospholipase C being activated simply means now it can operate as a kinase and phosphorylate other things as still a further signal transduction until eventually the end goal happens. And that's, you know, the farther you get along a signal transduction pathway, the more variable it can be from cell to cell. The common parts are the beginning that we've talked about in here. In individual specific kinds of cells, the end part of that signal transduction, those final steps, are what are different and therefore lead to potentially totally different results in different types of cells in response to the overall original signal. Calcium comes into play as well here. Now, calcium itself is an important signal that's used for various reasons. It's a versatile signal as well. So we're talking about the major versatile signals in this chapter for the most part. I'm giving you examples, but the main importance is what they share. So cyclic AMP is a big signal. Protein kinase A, protein kinase C, IP3, DAG, G proteins, these are all important things that we keep going over. But calcium itself is a signal, which you should already know because we've already talked about calcium operating as a signal, right? There are many other examples, though, beyond what we've already talked about in terms of we talked about it for neuronal signaling. Right, it's an important signal because the influx of calcium into the axon terminal in a neuron is what causes the exocytotic release of the neurotransmitter. So it's an important signal for that reason. It's also an important signal in skeletal muscle and, well, actually skeletal and cardiac muscle both. We talked about calcium binding to a protein in order for actin and myosin to slide past each other. But that's not all it does. It does all kinds of other things as well. It's just a versatile signal. Calcium ions, though, are usually very low concentration in the intracellular fluid. Now, this is why, by the way, they rush into the axon terminal in response to those voltage-gated calcium ion channels opening up, right? The gradient is already in place because the intracellular concentration of calcium ions is kept low. It's kept low for a couple reasons that are shown in this figure. One is that the plasma membrane features calcium ATPases. A calcium ATPase is a calcium pump. All right, so at the expense of ATP, calcium ions are continuously pumped from the intracellular fluid to the extracellular fluid. That's what creates the gradient for extracellular calcium to come into a cell if its channels are open. Channels are not always open, right? Otherwise, it would be a total waste of that ATP. But channels get opened, like the voltage-gated calcium ion channels at the end of a neuron that gets opened in response to an action potential. The gradient, though, is what drives it. That gradient is in place because of the pumps. At the same time, plasma membrane calcium pumps are pumping calcium out of the cytoplasm into the extracellular fluid. Other calcium pumps in the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum are busy also removing calcium ions from the cytosol, but pumping them into the lumen of the ER rather than into the extracellular fluid. So two different kinds of pumps simultaneously, and many copies of them, simultaneously are removing calcium from the cytosol and putting it into another compartment, extracellular fluid or ER lumen. The combined effects of these is that the intracellular concentration of calcium is kept very low. And so there's a strong gradient for flow of calcium ions into the cytosol, either from the extracellular fluid or from the ER lumen, if channels in either of those membranes open up. And there are channels in both of them. Okay? For instance, this ryanodine receptor channel is a calcium ion channel that can open up in the endoplasmic reticular membrane under certain situations. And in fact, that is exactly the kind of receptor that's in your skeletal muscles that open up in response to action potential in the muscle cell reaching those transverse tubules we talked about. That has the effect of opening up these ryanodine receptor channels. And since all along, calcium pumps have been sequestering calcium ions in the lumen of the smooth ER, which in a muscle cell, that's called the sarcoplasmic reticulum, but it's still endoplasmic reticulum. Because of those pumps, the gradient is high, and therefore calcium rushes out into the cytosol. That's when it operates as a signal, when it's suddenly there in the cytosol. But the same thing happens if it's suddenly there in the cytosol because it's coming in from outside the cell. Like when it's operating as a signal for exocytosis of neurotransmitters, when it enters a neuronal, an axon terminal. Okay, so one thing that actually triggers the opening of, I mean, another thing that triggers beyond these ryanodine receptor channels, the triggering of the opening of calcium ion channels in the ER, a different kind of channel, is IP3 itself. So there are these blue things where number 4 is labeled, called IP3 receptor channels that have that function, of course, as channels. Well, they are specifically calcium ion channels. But what kind of channels are they, functionally speaking? Ligand-gated ion channels, exactly. The particular ligand that opens up their gate is IP3. All right. So in response to a ligand coming along as the original signal from outside of the cell, binding to a G-protein-coupled receptor, the activation of that G-protein activates phospholipase C. Phospho, I mean, a version of phospholipase C. That's why it has the beta down here. Remember I said there's different versions of phospholipase C. That phospholipase C cleaves phosphatidyl inositol bisphosphate into diacyl glycerol and inositol trisphosphate, both of which are now active signals. The IP3, inositol trisphosphate, is now a ligand that can bind to IP3 receptor channels in the ER lumen. That has the effect of opening up those channels, and because the pumps have already been working to sequester the calcium ions in there, calcium will flow out into the cytosol and itself be a signal. Well, these ryanidine receptor channels that I was talking about, that are also calcium ion channels, they are themselves sensitive to calcium from the outside. So when some calcium comes out from the IP3 receptor channels, they will bind to ryanidine receptor channels and cause even more calcium to come out. So it is a blast of calcium as a strong signal all at once. All right. Now, meanwhile, you have a different source of IP3. Remember I said there's different kinds of phospholipase C. The other kind here, shown as PLC gamma, is activated in response to a different kind of receptor that we haven't talked about yet, but that we will, and that's a receptor tyrosine kinase, shown at the top. When it's activated, this alternative version of phospholipase C gets activated, but it has the same effect. It still cleaves PIP2 into IP3 and DAG, and therefore just helps out. They're both doing the same thing. Okay, by the way, I didn't mention it. Number three, the sodium-calcium exchanger. So sodium is being pumped directly out of the cytosol, whether it's into the lumen of the ER or into the extracellular fluid. That's primary active transport, meaning that the energy molecule is being spent right there at that pump. But there's also a lot of secondary active transport of calcium involving sodium-calcium exchangers. Now, why is this secondary active transport? It doesn't have anything to do with messengers, actually. It's what?
Using a gradient
of what? Of what ions? Of what positive ions? Sodium. Calcium is being pumped, right? It's moving against its gradient. No ATP is being spent here at this sodium-calcium exchanger. It's secondary active transport because what drags calcium out of the cell is the fact that sodium is diffusing into the cell. Why does sodium want to diffuse in, though? Because there's a steep gradient with respect to sodium maintained by still other pumps, the sodium pumps that we've been talking about. Right? So you spend the ATP directly at the sodium-potassium exchange pumps. That sequesters or stockpiles sodium in the outside. It wants to come in. And when it does come in through these exchange proteins, it forces calcium against its gradient in the opposite direction. So sodium is not being pumped. Sodium's diffusing. Calcium is being secondarily pumped via secondary active transport. Okay. Now to 16. Calcium as a signal does various things, as I've said, one of which is to activate a protein called calmodulin. Now, calcium in general has its effects by interacting with various kinds of proteins. When a calcium ion binds to a protein, there's a change that occurs. And in fact, when we talked about skeletal muscle cells, we already saw this happening, right? What was the specific protein that calcium interacted with in order to bring about contraction of the skeletal muscle? Anyone have any idea? Not tropomyosin. Troponin. Right. Troponin is a calcium-dependent protein. It changes shape into one form or the other depending on whether calcium is there. So that's one way that calcium operates as a signal, by binding to a protein. Calmodulin is another calcium-dependent protein that has receptor sites for calcium on it. In fact, it has four different calcium receptor sites on the same calmodulin molecule. And when and just the story is the same. When calcium is present, it will bind. And when it does bind, the shape will change. And when that shape changes of calmodulin, then it causes interaction with still other proteins that wouldn't happen in the original shape of calmodulin, the unbound shape. So the purple thing is the target protein. Whatever that is depends, right? But the point is that target protein is going to operate one way or another depending on whether calmodulin wraps around it or not. And what's going to cause calmodulin to wrap around that protein is the binding of calcium to calmodulin. If calcium, you know, if the signal, the original signal that started this whole transduction cascade, is now absent and everything returns to normal, the pumps will make calcium ions scarce again in the cytosol, in which case they will detach from calmodulin and it will go back into its normal shape, just like troponin or troponin goes back into its normal shape and reverses the effect. Same thing here. 17. Now we can finally look at a receptor tyrosine kinase that I mentioned a little bit ago. Now there are different kinds of receptor tyrosine kinases. This is just one example, but it's a typical example. This specific example is one that is a receptor for EGF, which is epidermal growth factor. That doesn't matter, actually. That's just the particular ligand that actually activates this particular example of a receptor tyrosine kinase. But the important thing is what happens to the receptor itself, and that's basically the same in the other examples as well. So EGF, it's just a ligand, all right? That's the original signal. But the receptor tyrosine kinase itself, as the name implies, is a receptor, it's a protein. It's a receptor and it's an enzyme, specifically a kinase. Okay? And as a protein, it's made up of amino acids, of course, like any polypeptide is. Well, there are 20 different biological amino acids, but one of those is tyrosine, right? Tyrosine is an amino acid. So in the overall sequence of amino acids that makes up this receptor tyrosine kinase, many of those amino acids in that sequence are tyrosines. Those are the only ones that are labeled here because those are the only ones that we really care about. But there's all kinds of other amino acids as well. That's part of the actual protein, though. It is a transmembrane protein, as you'd expect for it to receive a signal and transduce that information to the interior of the cell, right? But it's a single-pass protein, meaning it only goes through the thickness of the membrane once, unlike some other ones we've looked at. And, of course, the exteriorly facing part of the protein is the part that features the receptor site for whatever ligand. Now, notice that it actually requires multiple receptor tyrosine kinase molecules to come together and interact with each other for the signal to be transduced. So this is a single receptor. Two of them now in the second column have already received their ligand, so they are becoming activated. The shape change that occurs when the ligand binds to the external surface is such that it allows for these two to come together. And remember, they're kinases, so they are enzymes. Their enzymatic activity is enabled by the binding of the ligand to the exterior surface. But the phosphorylation that occurs is actually by one receptor to the other. One of these copies phosphorylates the tyrosines on the other copy. Okay? And the things that actually become phosphorylated are the tyrosines in that sequence. We can see this happening in the third column. All right? So now these tyrosines have been phosphorylated. This is now an activated receptor tyrosine kinase. And since the catalysis here, the enzymatic action, is occurring on the same molecule, it's called autophosphorylation. It's really the same type of molecule. There's two individual molecules here, right? Two polypeptides. But it's called autophosphorylation because it's phosphorylating itself rather than some other external molecule. That activates the the receptor tyrosine kinase. That's in general what happens regardless of what kind of receptor tyrosine kinase it is. What happens from then on totally depends on which kind of cell it's in and what specific example of receptor tyrosine kinase it is. But by being phosphorylated, the activated receptor tyrosine kinase can now do some stuff, and therefore it operates as an activated signal molecule. In 18, we can see an example of something that it can do. Actually, we've already looked at one of the two things that are being shown here. Once the tyrosines are phosphorylated, that allows the polypeptides that those tyrosines are part of to interact with other proteins that are already in the cytosol, because the tyrosine residues are in the cytosolic portion of this transmembrane protein, right? One of those kinds of proteins that can now interact with the phosphorylated receptor tyrosine kinase is this phospholipase C type gamma that we already looked at. And so when that comes along and associates with the activated receptor tyrosine kinase, it now has catalytic activity, which allows it to split phosphatidyl inositol bisphosphate into diacylglycerol and inositol trisphosphate, like we've already talked about. The other thing being shown here, and these are just a couple possibilities for this action, is that these blue adapter proteins, and it doesn't matter actually what their names are even, they are adapter proteins that come along and can bind only if it's phosphorylated, only if the receptor tyrosine kinase is activated. And if that happens, then there can be further association with the green thing, the RAS protein, which is yet another signal that's used quite often in cells. And actually, it is another example of a G protein, but it's a different kind of G protein. The RAS protein is a monomeric G protein. It's only one polypeptide. It's not three with an alpha, beta, and a gamma subunit. But despite that difference, it operates very similarly to the alpha subunit of the traditional G protein that we've already looked at, meaning that it can be bound to either GDP or GTP. And if it's GDP, it's not active. If GTP replaces the GDP, that's what activates it. Well, that happens in this case in response to these adapter proteins associating with the receptor tyrosine kinase after it's been bound to its ligand, and which allows for interaction with the RAS itself. That changes the shape such that a GTP can come along, displace the GDP, and activate the RAS. And then the RAS, as you see, can activate, and don't bother memorizing the names of these things, it activates another kinase, which is RAF. Notice that it's phosphorylated. It phosphorylates still another kinase, which is MEK, turns it on. The phosphorylated version of MEK is itself a kinase, which is what the K there stands for, and it phosphorylates still another kinase, MAPK, which then phosphorylates still other proteins inside the nucleus. Eventually, you have regulation of transcription. So the overall effect of this thing is to turn on the transcription of a gene that codes for some protein. But it's many, many steps. Now, it's annoyingly complicated if you're trying to study this, of course. But like I said before, it's nice for the cell to have all those different steps, because at each step you can have amplification, right? Each preceding step can cause multiple copies of the next step. And therefore, one original ligand serving as the first messenger outside the cell can have a huge effect in terms of the number of ultimate molecules being produced. 19. Here we're kind of bringing this all together and showing you that there can be crosstalk. Not only are these individual signal transduction pathways complicated in isolation, but they actually don't operate usually just in isolation. There can be crosstalk, meaning one pathway can affect another pathway while it's happening. And that's what's happening with these red arrows. So, for instance, a ligand might open up an ion channel as the original signal. It can open up a ligand-gated ion channel. That causes flow of ions. Well, if it's calcium ions, then that can, of course, activate calmodulins. That's one way for that to happen. But the same ligand might actually activate a G protein-coupled receptor that activates phospholipase C, which is going to also cause increase in calcium ion concentration because of what we just said, right? The phospholipase C is going to split PIP2 into DAG and IP3. IP3 is going to bind to ER receptors for calcium that are calcium channels, and it's going to flood calcium out. So that's part of the crosstalk that I'm talking about here. The receptor tyrosine kinase can have its own contribution to that original ligand. So three different receptor types, each responsible for its own signal transduction pathway, are operating those pathways, but the pathways are crosstalking because they share intermediates, basically. They interfere with each other. And so it's even more complicated than just when you study them in isolation. 20. We're looking at the activity of a hormone. Now, we've been talking about signals all along, and hormones are signals, but hormones are specifically long-range signals, right? The hormone is, like I said, not a chemical distinction, whether something's a hormone or a short-range signal, an autocrine or a paracrine signal, is not because of what it is. It's because of how it operates. And so hormones, as I said, get broadcast throughout the body because they get carried by the blood. And they have totally different effects in different kinds of cells, or just no effect at all, right? Why is it that they would have no effect at all at certain tissues? If there's an absence of the kind of receptor required to fit that sort of hormone as a signal, then, yeah, they won't even know that hormone is there. Because of the basic point that any signal molecule has no effect unless it's able to bind to a receptor. So the reason that you can have totally different effects in the multiple tissues, of course, is because there's not just one type of receptor for a given hormone. There are multiple receptors, like we've been talking about. There are multiple receptors. And so the cells in one tissue might have one receptor. The cells in another tissue might have a totally different receptor. But even if they were the same receptor, you could have different responses ultimately, right? Because anything that you change along the way in these many steps of signal transduction will mean that the ultimate effect is different. So this is why simultaneously the release of epinephrine, which is a hormone, a stress hormone released from the adrenal glands that lie just on the kidneys, will have the effect at the heart muscle by binding to receptors there of increasing the heart rate. while at the same time binding to receptors in hepatocytes or liver cells and causing the breakdown of glycogen. Why would you want to break down glycogen in response to a stress hormone? Right. Glycogen is nothing but glucose, right? So a bunch of glucose is strung together, but in glycogen form, it's useless as a fuel. You want to burn that fuel, specifically the brain, right? The brain needs glucose continuously. So the epinephrine under stress tells the cells of the liver, break down the glycogen that you made just earlier when there was plenty of glucose around. Break that back down into glucose, put it in the bloodstream so the brain stays alive. And meanwhile, other tissues will be told by that same hormone, don't use your glucose, because you can use other sorts of fuels. Save it for the brain. Start breaking down fat. Okay, 21. Well, I just told you a minute ago that we can classify signals, functionally speaking, and the two broad classifications there are that we have long-range signals, which we call hormones, or short-range signals, which are either paracrine or autocrine, right? Those are the ones that don't get put into the bloodstream. They just operate very locally, either on a different kind of cell locally, paracrine, or the same kind of cell locally, autocrine. That's a functional distinction. But we can also classify signals structurally. So even though all of these hormones shown here are called hormones because they're long-range signals, there are different kinds of hormones, structurally speaking, based on what kind of chemicals make them up. And so there's a dichotomy within hormones, a two-part way of looking at things. Hormones are either hydrophilic or hydrophobic, which is an actual functional distinction, but nearly all of the all of the hydrophilic hormones are made out of amino acids or derivatives of amino acids. So they're either amino acid derivatives or they are polypeptides or oligopeptides. So these are all the amino acid based hormones. All of the ones that are hydrophilic are made of amino acids in one way or another. Okay? And that's what makes them hydrophilic. Nearly all of the ones that are hydrophobic are lipid-based, specifically cholesterol-based in animals, at least. Animals are not the only things with hormones. Plants use hormones as well. But in animals, the steroid hormones are made out of cholesterol. Cholesterol gets a functional group here and there modified and makes it into a different kind of signal. So as lipids, they are hydrophobic. But actually, there's also an example of a hydrophobic hormone in animals that is not lipid-based, but is amino acid-based. And that is thyroid hormones. So that's kind of an exception to the structure-function going together. But the reason that this is important, even though it's a structural difference that makes the distinction, whether it's amino acid based or not, it ends up making a functional importance because the amino acid based ones, with the exception of thyroid hormones, are hydrophilic, and therefore what's different about how they work compared to steroid hormones, which are hydrophobic? They cannot enter the cell, exactly. They meaning the hydrophilic ones. The amino acid-based ones, except for thyroid hormones, can't enter the cell because their hydrophilic nature disallows them from going through the phospholipid bilayer. So they're the ones that have these more complicated signal transduction cascades, and their job is done after they bind to the receptor facing the exterior of the cell. everything that happens beyond that is not actually their job. It just happens because of their presence. Okay? Whereas the steroid hormones, which is the minority of your hormones, and those are produced in two different places in your body, the adrenal glands and the gonads, those operate by going into the cell. And so their receptors, like I told you earlier, are found either in the cytosol or in the nuclear in the nucleoplasm. Because a membrane is a membrane. If you're a hydrophobic protein that's small enough to get through that phospholipid bilayer, you can get through any sort of phospholipid bilayer, including organellar membranes. And 22 shows you this, an example of a steroid hormone. Cortisol is a steroid hormone produced in the adrenal glands. It's another stress hormone. But epinephrine that we looked at before, what's another name for an epinephrine, by the way? Epinephrine is the United States version of the name. Or what do they call it in jolly old England? Adrenaline, yes. That's an amino acid-based one. Cortisol is another stress hormone, but it's a steroid stress hormone. It's a glucocorticoid, so-called, because it affects glucose metabolism, and it's made in the cortex of the adrenal gland, the adrenal cortex. And it's an oid because it's a steroid. So glucocorticoid refers to where it's made and what it does. But anyway, the S thing here, standing for steroid hormone in general, cortisol is just an example, but the S, the steroid hormone, because it's hydrophobic, can enter the cell. That's where it finds its receptor. GR is the receptor, but notice that GR, which is a protein, is first, in this example, conjugated with or bound to another protein labeled as a heat shock protein. But what did we talk about heat shock proteins in the past? What did we say about them? I mean, in what context did I mention them? Chaperones, right. Right, chaperones that help things fold up into the right shape, but they also, chaperones can keep proteins from doing things for the moment. And in this case, it's keeping this receptor from entering the nucleus by being bound up with this big protein, the heat shock protein. But when the signal comes along, which is cortisol itself, the binding of cortisol to the receptor site on the receptor frees up the heat shock protein, and therefore this receptor signal complex, in other words, cortisol and the receptor combined, can migrate into the nucleus, and along with another one of the same, another complex, side by side, form a dimer on a certain part of the DNA, and the dimer, the presence of the dimer on the receiving part, the response element of the DNA that, you know, we talked about response elements in a different chapter, that is what actually initiates the transcription of the corresponding gene. And so RNA is made. If it's a protein coding gene, which it usually is, that's messenger RNA, and then that will be translated into a polypeptide. And like I said in a different lecture, this is why steroid hormones usually have longer time to respond to the original signal. They have a delayed effect because doing all of this transcription and translation takes some time rather than immediately activating things that are already there in the cytosol via these transduction cascade mechanisms that we've been talking about in response to hydrophilic signals just knocking on the door on the outside. Okay, that's it.